Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Mutual Fund Observer interview with David Sherman, the manager of the River Park Short-Term High Yield Fund conference call. All participants will be in a listen-only mode. Should you need assistance, you may signal a conference specialist by pressing the star key followed by zero. After today's presentation, there will be an opportunity for you to ask questions. Please also note that today's event is being recorded. I would now like to turn the conference call over to Mr. David Snowball. Mr. Snowball, please go ahead.
Hi, guys. Welcome, and thank you for joining us tonight. It's been over a year since the Observer first profiled the River Park Short-Term High Yield Fund. We're kind of grateful for the opportunity to chat with David tonight about the year just passed and about what he anticipates in the year ahead. I should note by way of disclosure that part of my own portfolio is invested in the fund, although the Observer has no kind of financial relationship with River Park or the good folks at Cohansic. The results of this conversation will be reflected both in an updated profile that we'll publish on October 1st, and the audio will be available for folks online. Both River Park and the Observer will post links to that so that if there are folks who are interested and were not able to join us tonight, they'll be able to dial to listen into it. Our plan is fairly simple. I was going to ask Morty Shia, president of the River Park Funds, to give us a few opening thoughts about the fund. I was then going to ask a few questions of David. Out of respect, for your time, we're going to try to keep our questions and answers fairly brief. The nature of the thing is that David is enormously knowledgeable and very kind of engaging and enthusiastic about his investments, and so his answers could go to much greater depth than we will on the first round. If David shares an answer with you and your thought is, gee, I wish I could hear more, we're going to, in the third section, open it up, either for your original questions or for follow-ups to what we've already talked about. We're looking very much forward to hearing from you, and with that, I thought I would turn it over to Morty Shia to give us a bit of an introduction.
Thanks, David. So we're very happy to participate in this conference call. We're excited to sort of open up the dialogue to our outside investors, and Mutual Fund Observer is a great opportunity for us to do that. Let me sort of introduce the fund real quick, and then we can go into a lot of detail with David Sherman. So the short-term high yield fund is something that we perceive as quite a unique fund within the marketplace. And while it's called a short-term high-yield fund, it's really partly a short-term high-yield fund, but we don't think of it that way. Yes, it's invested in high-yield bonds with short-term maturities, and you'll see that, as you, review the Observer analysis or as you listen to David. But we think of it as almost a cash alternative. We're managing the fund to low risk as opposed to searching for yield. And so as you listen to David talk about the fund, you'll hear him talking about different special situations, different ways where we can invest in something that might be rated high yield, but we perceive have very limited credit risk and very limited interest rate risk. And frankly, we're willing to take the yield that the market is giving us for that risk profile that we're willing to accept. Our target, from inception was something in the 300 to 400 basis point range above money market funds. That's sort of what we were hoping for, and that was our target. It's been very successful. If anything, I think we're surpassing my expectations. The mutual fund's been around for a little under 2 years. It'll be 2 years, at the end of September. And in the 23 months ending August, the retail class literally averaged 4.01% per year. So it's really surpassed our expectation a little bit. We're just very excited about it. The fund currently has about $180 million in it. It's going to remain small. Capacity is, anywhere from $600 million to $1 billion. Obviously depends on market conditions. We'll be watching that carefully, depending on market conditions. And right now, it's really all about execution, and it's been a lot of fun for us. Like David, I too am really an equity guy in the 30 years I've been in the business, And so so this fund has really been my first direct exposure to the fixed income world. And it's been a lot of fun for me in River Park, and that's sort of my introduction. So, David, it's all yours.
Great.
Great. Thanks, folks. This is my first time doing something like this, so if I start going off on a tangent, I apologize. I'm going to assume that most of you are somewhat familiar with the fund, so I'm going to go through a brief summary quickly. And before I do that, I just want to say a couple words on the development of the fund. Cohansic is our investment firm, and we specialize in high yield and credit opportunities. And Morty was introduced to me by a mutual friend, and Morty asked me about managing high yield money as a mutual fund or ETF. And at the time, I was a bit concerned about the liquidity of funds to invest in just plain vanilla high yield, because mutual funds are basically depositors, and high yield is basically a loan. And there can be a little bit of mismatch between the assets and the liabilities. So we talked about it, and we just, you know, I wasn't really comfortable making my first mutual fund venture in high yield. And I came to Morty and I said, but we have been managing our cash balances when they're excess in a unique strategy, and I've been doing it even when I was at Leucadia, where we buy called and redeemed debt. So these are corporations where they had issued debt in the past. They've come to market with new debt to refinance out their old debt. And the old debt's still out there for some period of time, usually 30 days, because there's a requirement to give bondholders notice before they can take them out. And those bonds trade at very low yields, but they're what I consider incredibly safe credits at that point, especially if you do some basic financial analysis and some basic business analysis. And you can pick up really attractive yields and have your money naturally, you invest in it and naturally converts back to cash in a 30-day period. And that was the whole evolution of how we got thinking about the River Park Short-Term High Yield Bond Fund and also how to set up the portfolio appropriately. So it's maybe misnamed, but that's sort of what the strategy primarily was. This fund, I think, is really set up to obviously, if the high yield market goes down like the third quarter of last year, this fund will also suffer some price impairment on a mark-to-market basis, not permanent, in our opinion. And the third quarter, to give you an idea of last year, was down 6% for the high yield market. For Merrill Lynch's short-term high yield index, it was down over 3+%, I think 3.5%. Our fund was down about 1 basis point for the institutional and 7 for the retail. So it did truly stay under the guise that we have suggested as sort of a don't break the buck sort of 90-day strategy. So the portfolio at the end of August, so these are the most current numbers available, the portfolio today has a expected yield based on purchase of about 4.24% gross. That's a yield to worst, with an expected portfolio maturity of January 27th, 2013. So this is the end of August, so you have basically a five-month portfolio. We expected 50% of the portfolio to naturally convert into cash over a 60-day period of time, and that's not unusual. Traditionally, this fund has had an average maturity of 4 to 8 months, has traditionally generated returns for the investors of net of fees now, call it 3.5 to 4.5, closer to the 4.5 number, and historically 40 to 60% of the portfolio has naturally transacted into cash over a 90-day period of time. The portfolio has the ability to buy things with an effective maturity of up to 3 years. At the end of August, the portfolio had about 12-13% with an effective maturity of longer than a year and less than 3 years. We actually think those positions will come out sooner, but to be very disciplined and true to understanding the risk we're taking on, we've categorized them there. Historically, that's been 25% or less over the life of this fund. And then to give investors an understanding, and also for us again, since it's a process-driven fund, to really appreciate the kind of risk we're being exposed to, we've categorized the fund into 5 basic categories. We may add categories if it's appropriate down the road, but today there's five. One is redeem debt. That's exactly what I suggested. So these are companies who've come to market with new debt. So they've issued new money. It's already been funded. And they definitely are using those proceeds to retire existing debt. And they send a notice to the trustee. So this isn't, we think we're going to do it, we might do it, it's been done. Which means the only way the company can reverse this transaction is by bankruptcy. There's no other way they can do it. So over the next 30 days, they've raised the money, they've sent notice, they've contractually changed the terms of the obligation where they've called the debt, they can't back out of it, other than bankruptcy, and they're going to take you out. And that's 30% of the portfolio, or a little bit more than that, on August 31st. Next category is event-driven. So these are corporations where there's an event that's occurred that's effectively going to create a longer-term maturity to be coming out sooner, making it a shorter-term maturity. It could be a company is doing a spin-off and they're going to be required to refinance their debt. It could be a company is being taken over, and as a result, we have the right to put the securities back to the company as a change of control provision. So those are examples of event-driven strategies, and there can be others. That was about 15% of the portfolio at the end of August. Again, these categories do change based on the market and based on what's going on. The next category, which is actually relatively low from where it's historically been, is what we call strategic recap. It's about 6% of the portfolio at the end of August. Strategic recap are companies who have publicly indicated they're planning to refinance out their debt. It's in a 10-Q, it's in a public PowerPoint presentation, but they made an affirmative statement. It's not Gohanzic sitting back and saying, we think the company is going to refinance this paper. The company has actually said it. So a typical example is a company will say, we're interested in issuing new debt, and we're going to use this new debt to take out our old debt, and it's contingent on us getting the financing done. That would be a typical example. And then a week later, or 3 days later, or 7 days later, depending on the roadshow goes, if they're successful, they'll take the debt out. Obviously, we have to take a little bit more serious credit risk analysis to determine if they're unsuccessful, what would happen to our bond, and can they be successful? And just because they say they want to do it, does it really? Are they being realistic? The next category is about 18% of the portfolio on August 31st. It's cushion bonds. The definition of a cushion bond is that the yield goes up as the maturity gets extended. So these are securities that are callable now or callable very shortly, like a month from now, 2 months from now, 3 months from now, where the bonds are being priced to the call. But if they don't call the paper, the coupon on the debt itself is sufficiently large that you get paid more as it stays outstanding. And remember, our absolute maturity still can't be more than 3 years on this paper. So it might be a company, we've had one for years in the portfolio called SGS International. Unfortunately, SGS just got sold, so it's gone from a cushion bond to a company that's being taken out. And they had done a partial call in December, but that was a company with a 12% coupon that was callable immediately on 30 days notice at par or 100. So it was going to be constrained on how high it would trade. And if you bought paper, in a simple example, at 101, that means you were going to pay a dollar premium, and in 30 days you would earn a dollar in interest. That's 12% divided by 12 months. So you'd make a zero return if they called it that day. But if it took them 5 or 6 months, call it 6 months to call you, you would have earned 6 points in interest, 12 divided by 2 for half a year, and minus the 1 point premium, you would have earned 5 points over 101. So that's an example of how a cushion bond works. And then the last category, which is about 30% of the portfolio, and that should add up to 100 or pretty close because I've been rounding, are outright short-term maturities. So these are companies where they have a stated maturity, and that's the stated maturity, and we expect either through internal operations or current liquidity, they'll be able to retire this debt. So that's what you might think of as traditional high-yield paper, although very, very short. And then we're very, very careful with this paper. We'd much rather get a much lower return for higher quality and higher level of certainty because we're not managing the portfolio for total return. If you want total return, there are all kinds of high-yield options that people can look to. We look at this as how can we get you a really high-quality yield that you can't get for a short-term portfolio without the significant kind of credit risks you might take in a traditional high-yield portfolio. That's basically the construct. And then the only – I guess I'll leave you with two other things before – I could be interrupted. One is at the end of the month, to give you an idea of how much the cash flow works off, in T plus one, so using the end of the month, in the first trading day, 12% of the portfolio would be in cash. By the second day, 15% would be in cash. By literally just 10 days later, 30% would roll into cash. And by the end of 30 days, 55% was going to roll into cash. So you can see there's just a natural progression of, and that's excluding coupons, of just the bonds rolling into cash. And to give you an idea of how labor-intensive and how execution-driven this is, I haven't calculated the actual average assets under management for the mutual fund. The mutual fund at the end of August 31st was $179 million. It's obviously a little larger today because we've been fortunate with inflows. To give you an idea, in January it was $33 million. So if you just want to say 33 plus 180, so that gets you 240 divided by 2, call it 120 of an average balance, we've purchased, not sold, just purchased over $442 million of securities through August. And of those, to give an idea of categories, called paper, called intended paper, has been anywhere between 40% and 67% of that purchase bucket every month. We've used 46 brokers throughout the year. The top 10 brokers only represent 60% of the transactions. So it's very labor intensive. So I think it's good from a standpoint of I think it limits some of the competition. It's bad because obviously everyone would prefer to not have as much labor-intensive business. And I think that's a pretty good sum up, don't you think, Morty?
Yeah, I think that's great. So maybe for the purpose of this conference call, maybe as opposed to using David and David, if it's okay, Snowball and Sherman. So Snowball, it's all yours.
Great. Sherman, I needed to check with you then on the percentages in the portfolio. I caught some of them, but I'm not sure that I did on the cushion bonds. How much of the most recent portfolio is in a cushion bond?
17.7.
So roughly 18%?
Yeah, I'll just repeat them for the five categories.
Yeah.
Call it 31% for redeemed debt, 15% for event-driven, 6% for strategic recap. And again, I'm rounding
right
here.
Right.
18% for cushion bonds and 30% for short-term maturities. And that should get you pretty close to 100%. And if not, it's a small rounding difference.
Right. Close enough. That's great. Your fund is one that generates more questions than almost any other that we cover anytime the subject comes up on the discussion board. I can pretty reliably expect to see dozens of questions and some hundreds of people sort of weighing in. And so I thought what I would do is take a second and ask, if I could, some of the questions that our readers had and see how close that comes to helping you understand or helping you explain what's up with the fund. The most common question is that because the fund is unique in its structure, at least as far as a 40 Act fund goes, folks aren't entirely sure what to do with it. They look at it. They think, wow, that seems very steady. Is it a bond? Is it a money market? Like, what mental box? How can you help them imagine in a traditional portfolio that, they think of as 60-40 stock and bond? How do they think about your fund?
Morty and I probably have two different answers for this. This is Sherman. My answer is I don't really know. I think what's unique about investing is each investment advisor has their own sort of view of both the proper makeup and how things fit in. Does this count as a cash alternative that's in high yielding? So it's really a way to take excess cash and earn an excess yield, waiting to reallocate when I have a greater conviction of where to reallocate. Is it an alternative to cash and an enhanced cash strategy? So instead of having my client ladder a 3-year treasury, a 2-year treasury, a 1-year treasury, a 6-month treasury, or buy CDs, I use this. I have had some people say to me, look, I want to have a certain percentage of my portfolio in high yield because, quite frankly, my clients expect it. And this is sort of the one that drags my high yield returns down in a bullish environment like we have today, but that when the world turns ugly, protects my portfolio. So it's like a barbell approach where you sacrifice yield for less risk, but it evens things out. So I think people have very different views. My favorite example, and then I'll ask Morty what he would say, is I have a cousin who was sending both her daughters off to college. She had, she was fortunate. She had $200,000 saved specifically for her children's education. And she said, look, I know one's going off in 6 months and one's going off 2 years later, and I know I'm going to write checks twice a year during the year, and I don't want to invest in the stock market because I can't afford to lose it. But I can certainly buy a short-term bond fund or a CD, and how do you fit? And I say, look, you know, I'm your cousin, and I'm a little biased, and I'm being your cousin, I have both mixed views on this, but I think the River Park Fund's perfect as part of a makeup for that. Because as long as you can sort of think 3 months out, I feel comfortable we can survive some volatility. And I mentioned the third quarter earlier in the call. The third quarter last year was the fourth worst quarter in high yield, measured in high yield, since 1986. So it was actually a pretty nasty quarter. I don't necessarily want to imply that in other nasty quarters performance will be the same. It might be better. It also might be worse. That's my whole disclosure comment for those who can appreciate that. But obviously, it is an example of something that happened historically. And maybe Morty has a view.
So, just as a reminder, when you talked about the third quarter, you said that depending on which share class, the fund was down between 1 and 7 basis points when the market was down 600 basis points.
Yes, one was institutional and 7 was retail. The distinction is the institutional is $1 million minimum and the retail is $1,000 minimum.
So you had about 1%, at least in that one quarter, you dropped about 1% or so.
No, one basis point.
Right, you dropped 1 basis point, which is 1% of what the average high yield fund lost.
If the average high yield fund lost 6%, we lost, less than 1% of what they lost,
right,
one basis point. Let's just call it we are break even. It'll make life easy and not confuse people.
Great. Right. Hey, Morty, sorry about that.
No problem. So I like David's answer. I would just add two quick thoughts to that. The first is post-2008, we're finding that a lot of people have allocated a much higher percentage of their investment portfolio to what they call cash. So that 60-40 model has become something else where there might be a 20% cash holding in that or something like that. And while this is not a money market fund and it's not a, you know, dollar managed fund, it does have risk and volatility. We can get into that if we want to a little later. But you know, it's clearly not a cash alternative, even though we are managing it that way. It is being used by investors across the board as part of that cash allocation. And what we're finding is for someone who wants to use it in that way, they're taking that cash allocation and they're saying, let me put anywhere from 10% or half of that cash allocation into this bond fund. The other side to that that we're experiencing is there are investors, high net worth, and advisors that just are basically beginning to phase out of the bond market. They're beginning to get scared of both interest rate risk, the run-up in high yield, and they're basically using this as a defensive play within high yield. So within that bond allocation, they're basically saying, well, we're really, you know, cutting back on our bond allocation by investing in this kind of, you know, conservatively managed bond fund.
Great. You talked, Morty, about this being a sort of guard against rising interest rates, and one of the folks on the board had asked what David's kind of take was on the prospect that interest rates would be rising. Would that have an effect on the fund, or is the maturity too short for it to notice?
Well, yours, David.
So, there's so many questions there. I think after today's announcement, I'm not sure, at least on the short end of the curve, we're going to see much rising interest rate in the near future. But you're definitely, it appears to be looking like you're going to have a steepening of the yield curve. So the longer dated stuff looks like they'll be paying significantly more than the shorter dated stuff. Look, in rising interest rates, it's a difficult question because in rising interest rates it depends on how much they move, how quickly they move, and where across the term structure they move. But as a basic answer and as a basic concept of rising interest rates, you know, the advantage of this fund is it has such a short life that you will be reinvesting at much higher rates much quicker. I mean, the duration on this fund is not significant for measurement. I mean, if you have a portfolio that has an average maturity of 6 months or 5 months, you know, 100 basis point move in interest rates is not really going to instantaneously, you know, will probably drop bond pricing in that kind of a portfolio. 100 basis points, 6 months, it's probably an average duration of 3 months, which is a quarter of a point. Whereas if you had a 10-year bond portfolio, you'd have a duration more like 6 or 7, you'd lose 7 bond points or 6 bond points. So clearly, a rising interest environment should have minimal impact on a mark-to-market basis on the fund, and you should be able to pick up the benefit of the reinvestment.
Sherman, let me follow up with a little bit on that question there. If interest rates were higher, do you feel that we can still target whatever, 300 to 400 basis points above money market funds, even if money market rates are at 2 or 3%?
I do. Some of this depends on where spreads are in the high-yield market itself. So what tends to happen in rising interest rates is actually spreads in high yield actually narrow initially. So there may be a brief period of time where instead of earning 300 or 400 over equivalent money market, we're going to earn 250 to 350, so a 50 basis point cushion. It doesn't last very long, but that does happen. Implicitly, high yield spreads on the index are reflective in the short-term part of this market.
Okay. Great. You'd mentioned that this is an intensely kind of this is a labor-intensive fund, given the number of brokers that you have to work with and the number of issues that you have to sort of research. And presumably that's reflected in the fund's expense ratio. At least a couple people had written questions about that. Right now, River Park has waivers in place that cap the ratio at 1% for the institutional shares, 1.25 for retail. Folks had asked a combination of questions, one of which is, are you getting close to the point where you won't need those waivers anymore? And in the long term, do you see the expenses dropping below that point?
That's a Morty question.
Yep.
So, okay, so one, yeah, we are getting closer to the point where fee waivers will not be necessary. Met actually with the mutual fund accountants today. You know, we're beginning the process of preparing our year-end numbers, which is, you know, September fiscal year. So when we do publish those numbers, you'll begin to see the ratcheting down of what we think of as the gross expense ratio before waivers to the, you know, to the net ratio, which includes the waivers. So let me answer the latter part of that, which is the more important. One, we are continuing the fee waivers, meaning that we have mandated to the fund that we will continue those indefinitely so that investors shouldn't be concerned that all of a sudden the expense ratio will go above those caps. Those caps will remain in place. Unfortunately, the latter part of it is it's not likely at any point soon that the expense ratio will drop below those stated 1% or 1.25% rates. You know, to the extent that it happens, it would likely happen a couple of years from now. And given that we would probably cap the size of the fund, meaning we would, you know, we basically close it to new investors at some point, or soft close it to new investors, it's not likely that it'll ever get big enough to really take advantage of those real economies of scale.
Okay. Great. I thought we would ask if it made sense to you folks, one more question, and then see if the folks who've been waiting so patiently, since we're about a half hour into this, see if any of the folks who are listening in on the call had questions for us.
Sure.
And the other question that comes up fairly consistently on the board is the suspicion that the fund seems a little too good to be true. The volatility has been very low this month. There were volatility in the broader market that resulted in a 2-cent drop in your net asset value, which reverses itself within 2 days, as it turns out. And a number of our readers are wondering where you see risk in the future lying. Are there either because there are too few callable bonds being issued, or is there some place where, you know, as you're lying there at night, you're thinking, oh, that could get bad?
Okay, so I'm going to start with the answer, and then I'm going to turn it over to Morty.
Great.
There's nothing in this portfolio where I wake up and where I spend go to bed at night where I can't fall asleep about this portfolio, where I wake up thinking, or I sit up thinking, oh, what could go wrong from, is there something bad going to happen? It doesn't mean that I don't think about the issue. It's a pretty solid portfolio, and I think in the scheme of risk, it's on the lower end of the risk chart. You know, when the high yield market last year in the third quarter was really widening out, pretty steepening, I was really excited. I was practically giddy because, you know, paper that we had bought, like Hospital Corp of America, at a 4.5% and 5% yield to call because they had funded and called them, we're now trading with 5 days left before they were going to be taken out at 17 or 18%. Now, granted, I was only earning a 17 or 18% annualized return for 5 business days, but, you know, that was pretty exciting to me because the cash was there and they were being taken out and Hospital Corp wasn't going to file bankruptcy. That being said, look, there's no question in volatile times of the market, and particularly when high yield, I mean, you can look at high yield, and when high yield starts weakening and spreads start widening out, the area of our portfolio is most likely to be susceptible to mark-to-market losses will be the longer duration in the portfolio. So you start looking at the 1 to 3 year segment, and that's where we're most likely going to suffer as well as our peers. I mean, at some point, people want to sell, and they just keep selling until there's a clearing price, and we're mark-to-market, and that'll be reflected. So on the longer end of the portfolio, you will see some volatility. And you'll see that. As far as product, I actually am not currently concerned about finding product in the categories we've mentioned, either under the current interest rate environment or under sort of a future environment. One, because our size is still relatively small, and we think we're not having difficulty putting money to work, and I don't think we are close to having that point. And two, I think we've positioned ourselves where I think there is a benefit to being a first mover. You know, for the example, a good and bad example. So Nuveen came to market with a debt deal they were going to use to refinance their existing bonds. We didn't buy the existing bonds until after the new deal priced and was closed, so it was done. And the reason is I hope I don't offend anyone on the phone. Nuveen is not what I consider the strongest credit, so I didn't want to take the risk that the deal didn't get done and I'd be stuck with short-term paper in Nuveen. But as soon as it got done, what was interesting was there was a large mutual fund. I think they had 50 million bonds, and they wanted to buy the new issue, but they couldn't own the old issue and the new issue because it would double their credit exposure, even if one was coming out soon. So as part of their agreement that they would buy the new piece, they had to unload the other piece, and the underwriter was Deutsche Bank, and Deutsche Bank picked up the phone and called us and said, we have a block, how much can you take and do you want it? It's interesting, when we first, a year ago when we had this fund up and running, because we were smaller and our ability to take down bigger pieces was lower and we were less known, we'd have to call the underwriter and say, we know you're doing this deal. If you see anything, let us know. Now the underwriters themselves are calling us. So that I think, is somewhat of an advantage. And then the price point. Then you mentioned the volatility or the pricing. Some of this is, unfortunately, our NAV is priced to 2 digits, 2 decimal points. And if it were priced to 3 decimal points, you wouldn't see quite as much volatility. So obviously, if it's at 10.04, and the next day it goes to 10.004, excuse me, and the next day it goes to, you know, it'll price out at 10, and the next day if it goes to 10.005, it'll price at 10.01, and then obviously if it changes, it'll go back down. That can make an adjustment of plus or minus a penny. That's one way. And we don't price it. We don't price the portfolio. It's priced by SEI and outside pricing. We do review it to make sure it's not completely off base, and we don't try to challenge it very often. Most of the time, and we tend to challenge it more when we think it's overpriced, because we know if it's underpriced, it'll sort of work its way out. And the other thing, though, is when we have a large amount of cash roll off, we're going back into the market and buying, and there's a natural bid-ask spread. So if we buy on the bid, we buy on the ask, and that night it gets priced on the bid, which is how it should be priced, we're going to have a price loss in that position. So if we have enough cash that's rolled off and that we're putting it to work quickly, you can see that happen for a day or so. And then occasionally, you know, there's just sort of an oddball pricing event. I think it's pretty rare. And at this point, I guess I'll address that part over and some of the other pricing issues to Morty.
Okay. I'd like to answer that, but just in the spirit of time, Jamie, do you want to make an announcement in terms of how people can call in, and then I'll answer the question while they're getting ready to call in?
Sure. If you would like to pose a question, please press star and then one using a touchtone telephone. To withdraw your question, you may press star and then two. Again, it is star and then one to ask a question.
Okay, let me answer that question. So as David suggested, I mean, the pricing of bonds is not really a science as much on a daily basis as much as it's partly an art. So it's not like, you know, IBM closing at a certain stock price and it closes the New York Stock Exchange and everyone knows what the price is. Over here, you're relying on pricing, outside pricing services, and that's what SEI is using, which is our administrator, to price the fund. You know, literally, as an example, earlier this week, and I think in one of your readers actually called in about this, there was an aberration for a day. Part of that aberration was literally a price that I look at and I say, boy, you know, that's a bad price, so that wasn't really a good price. And, you know, we could have challenged it. We didn't challenge it. And literally, this was part of a discussion I had with the outside accountants earlier today when I met with them. And we're putting in increasingly more and more procedures to identify those price outliers towards the end of the day as they get priced before the NAV gets published. So I think that over time, that component of the price volatility, which I perceive as artificial or really, you know, phantom price volatility, because it's really not the portfolio that's moving, it's just literally how the portfolio got priced that day and disappears or reverses the next day, that part will get better and better over time. It's better now than it was 6 months ago. And these changes we made today, I think, will improve it going forward. And that part will get eliminated. The daily noise in terms of how you mark the portfolio to market will exist, and it'll always exist. And as David suggested, you know, we believe that with very few exceptions, that as these, you know, securities roll over and mature, that will then get full price anyway, so that it just becomes a mark-to-market issue as opposed to really an impairment to actual value. And so, Jamie, are there any calls on the line?
We do have a question, and our question comes from Rafiq Gabriel. Please go ahead with your question.
Yes, hi. This is a question for David. I would probably use this as a cash alternative to begin with, and from that perspective, I would look at the worst-case scenario, and I know you've been running the strategy a lot longer than the mutual fund has been live. How did the strategy perform during the liquidity crisis? Because I would consider that as one of the, you know, most important worst-case scenarios when there's just nothing happening in the markets.
Okay, so I understand the question, and I get this question quite a lot. The answer I am going to give you is going to be somewhat unsatisfactory to you, which is we didn't run a dedicated strategy in 08. We obviously use some of this stuff from time to time when we had excess cash balances to enhance our cash returns, but we didn't run a dedicated strategy. So it's not that I don't know what the answer is because we've never been able to, we never went back and calculated or tried to figure it out because it wasn't a dedicated strategy. And to be quite frank, let's take October of 08. Truthfully, my biggest concern in October of 08 was, did I want my cash balances at Morgan Stanley to be at Morgan Stanley as an unsecured creditor of Morgan Stanley, or did I want to buy treasuries at a negative yield and then end up being on margin or being fully invested, but then I wouldn't be a creditor of Morgan Stanley, but if Morgan Stanley went broke, I'd have to unwind it. And actually, I chose the treasuries. So I was, in my previous career, for 10 years, an executive at Leucadia National, and one of my line responsibilities was treasurer of their insurance operation. I think the best way I can answer this is, in a really awful economic financial market environment, economic environment, I'm going to run the fund to preserve as much principal and capital and do what's smart. And if that means we have to go 100% to treasuries, that's what we're going to do.
Thank you.
Jamie, any other calls?
And once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star and one using a touch-tone telephone. And we do have an additional question. This question comes from David Reidish. Please go ahead with your question.
Yes, hi. I understand some of the things you've been talking about with, in terms of market volatility for high yields and how it will be a temporary setback for the fund. And as but in terms of permanent setbacks, if one of the bonds that you own, the company actually goes bankrupt, what impact would that have? And do you feel like they're so safe that it's never going to happen, or do you acknowledge that it might happen at some point?
Okay. So, look, I think we're very, very, very extremely careful in our credit selection, and I also think the profile of the investments limit the risk of price decline due to credit mistakes, which is what you're, I mean, the company doesn't have to, I want to be clear, a company doesn't have to go bankrupt for you to suffer a serious mark-to-market loss and make the determination if it's going to be permanent by selling it. So the answer is, I mean, a called bond, to take the most conservative side, a company that went out and raised the money sitting there, they mentioned that the use of proceeds was to call their debt, and then they sent a notice to the trustee. Again, that the only way they're going to get out of that is through bankruptcy. And I think if you avoid businesses where, let's say, it's a single oil driller in the Gulf, or it's a nuclear power plant that might have a meltdown, or somebody has a lot of litigation outstanding at the time that are contingent liabilities or business risks that aren't analyzable from the financials, and you focus on that, I think you limit that likelihood. And I've actually never seen a called bond go bankrupt. It doesn't mean it won't, but I haven't. And I've been in the business since 86. Obviously, look, do I think we can lose money by making a mistake? Absolutely. Do I think we take a higher level of prudency or willing to sacrifice return to eliminate that, lower that risk in this fund? Absolutely. So, for instance, so the answer is I do acknowledge it could happen. I've been doing this a long time. I think I'm pretty good at it. I think I'm pretty good at assessing it. And I think the team is pretty good at it. I don't want to say it won't happen. I feel pretty comfortable that we're likely to avoid that. And I'll give you a couple examples of things that we won't do, and that might help you understand.
David, let me just feed you a question as part of that. Maybe you could address the in the bucket that theoretically would have the greatest credit risk, which would be that short-term maturity bucket. Maybe you can talk to diversification, how big of a position size you would put into a single, you know, single security or something like that.
Okay, so generally no position exceeds 5% of the fund, and usually the short-term pieces are between 1 to 3%. Those actually are probably, from a wealth advisor's perspective, seems like actually a pretty big percentage. I don't really think it is based on my experience in high yield and the credit risk. And in the short-term space, these are companies where I have to look at each individual name, but in most cases, they're generating enough cash flow that they could actually pay off the debt from their current cash flow and their current balance sheet. So, you know, it's not something where in a financial meltdown they're all of a sudden not going to be able to withstand it is easy. I mean, there are junk bond companies which I think are high quality. In a thing, what I was going to say, it's almost easier if I go back and give you some things we won't do and then you'll understand. So, for instance, Jefferies, which is a very fine brokerage firm in my opinion, which my former employer owns a large stake in, was written up negative bias by Egan Jones in the fourth quarter of last year, and they had short-term debt that was maturing in January. And the bonds dropped precipitously, and many brokers called me and said, you should buy those bonds. You know the company. You think Jefferies is money good, and you'll make this great yield, and they're coming out in January. And I said, I'm not even going to look at them. And they said, why? I said, it's a financial institution where its life is dependent on being able to access capital on a regular basis. I mean, daily capital. And they're levered. And those are two bad things, because if the access disappears, it doesn't matter what their balance sheet is. If their money goes down the road, they're going to default. So even though I think they're fine and it might be an appropriate investment, let's say, to buy the stock when it dropped a lot for an equity fund or a hedge fund, it's not an appropriate bond for this fund. We're not interested in taking what I call widowmaker risk, where you're going to get a really good yield because you think it's going to work out, but if it doesn't, you want to jump from the roof of the building. I sort of think of this as a widows and orphans fund. So there are companies that have short-term maturities where they're subordinate in the capital structure, and if the company were to file bankruptcy today, they would be impaired. They wouldn't be worth par. And we don't buy those because at the end of the day, I have to assume a company may file bankruptcy no matter how good we think we are. And if it does, I have to do a waterfall analysis, a true analysis under a liquidation scenario of am I going to be okay. And I'm only interested in looking at those names where we're going to end up getting 100 cents based on that analysis.
David, one of the things that you haven't mentioned yet, which maybe this would be a good time to mention it, is that you will from time to time buy a security that is in bankruptcy.
Correct. They generally show up under the event-driven strategy. So we actually will buy securities in bankruptcy. I think one of the things unique about this fund is we have a lot of experience with stressed and stressed credits, which allows us to see things that I'm not sure other short-term or even normal high-yield mutual funds are likely to take advantage of. And we'll buy distressed companies when they're coming out of bankruptcy, and the plan is to give you cash. So these are companies where we're not going to get stock. We're not a distressed vulture investor hoping to make money as an equity investor. We're buying it where the confirmed bankruptcy plan is to give you cash, and the cash is expected or is there. So the two examples that we've most recently done in this fund since its life, General Growth, which was a very successful bankruptcy. Equity holders did quite fine, actually. But when it came out of bankruptcy, the plan was to give bondholders all of their principal, all of their pre-petition interest, all of their post-petition interest, and all of their interest on interest. And this was a plan confirmed by a statutory bankruptcy judge. So in some ways, it's kind of funny. A lot of people worried about the bankruptcy risk, and here I have the court they're worried about sanctioning that I'm going to get 100 cents cash. What I didn't know at the time was it going to exit bankruptcy in October, November, or December? So we had to calculate what the returns were going to be based on our purchase, based on the maturity date, the time value of date. But we knew we were going to get our money back. We just were uncertain about the time. And that's a good example. The other bankruptcy, which we can talk about later if people are interested, they can call me later, is Washington Mutual Floating Rate, where there was cash at the holdco. But General Growth is one that I particularly like because people sort of know the name, and a lot of people, I think, have appreciated the story.
Great. Other folks on the line, Jamie?
We have one additional question. This comes from Kai. Please go ahead with your question.
Hi. I've seen some media reports about some new bond trading platforms from Goldman, BlackRock, some of these other financial institutions. I was just wondering, is that relevant to their day-to-day work at all, and does that either make your life easier, or does it increase competition, or is it just not relevant altogether?
It's definitely relevant. I view it as a positive. I think any time there's more transparency in the market and systems that allow you to reduce the spread between the bid and the ask so the dealer makes less money is a good thing. I'm aware of several of the systems. There are some systems where there's a lot of fanfare that's been announced, but not really much happening. Most of the systems, the three biggest, which we subscribe to all of them when it makes sense. the three biggest in high yield tend to be MarketAxess, Bonds.com, and I think Bond Edge maybe. The problem is many of the systems are really meant for odd lots or lots less than a million or at max a million, million and a half, which is great because we're more than happy to pick up remnants at good prices, but it's not going to get very far when your fund starts getting to be $200-300 million. Two, I think bond.com is going to actually be an executing system, but most of them are more quote systems. You know, you indicate you're interested in buying, or they indicate they're interested in selling. It was like the pink sheets. And then you put it out there and they offer to, and then you accept it. But it's not like, like NASDAQ or like getting on Instanet and there's a bid and there's an offer and you can hit it or you can lift it or you can be taken by providing liquidity. It doesn't work like that right at the moment. I hope it gets there, but it doesn't. As a side note, what actually tends to happen, particularly in MarketAxess, which tends to use bigger volumes, is you have traders who are trading both in high yield, both the high yield product and on the market system. And they don't always pay attention, and they're making lots of markets. So we actually, in MarketAxess, multiple times, it happens at least once a quarter, and usually more often, you know, a bond will have just been called. Like, the notice is out. It's in public domain, but the guy doesn't realize it. And we're able to lift him off that system at a deep discount. And then inevitably what happens is they call you and they say, oh, you know, our guy didn't know. We made a mistake. Can we back out of the trade? So over the years, we've gotten a little wiser. And now when that happens, we pick up the phone and we call them because now we know who's on the other side because we've been using the system long enough. And we say, you know, we're happy to take your bonds at that price, but I just want you to know they've been called and the call price is 105 and you're offering them at 104.5 and I'm going to be really happy. And if you're still alive, we'd appreciate it. And usually some people will say, no, I'm not interested. Thank you very much. But usually over time when you build a relationship, what they say is, you know, thank you for telling me. I'll give you the bonds. I'd like to change my price. But they try to do it at what we would consider an attractive price. And the reason it works for both sides is if we take advantage of them because they're trying to do too many things at once, they'll just cut us off the system and they won't work with us anymore. And by the same token, now they sort of view us as a resource. They know if they make a mistake and we're out there looking for it, hopefully we get to them before somebody else goes, we'll tell them the truth.
Great.
And gentlemen, at this time I'm showing no additional questions.
Could you tell me a little bit, Dave, about, as you think about the fund growing, whether you're imagining changes or additional sorts of securities that you would imagine adding to the portfolio, or are you fairly sure that the five categories that you've indicated are what you'll be sticking with for the next couple hundred million?
I plan to stick with the five categories. When I mentioned adding categories, I was trying to hedge myself because as the world changes, you know, we may want to provide more transparency by calling it, by creating a new category so that the investor, the underlying investor, can say, aha, instead of putting one of these five buckets, they're giving me even more clarity and more transparency.
Sure.
And that always can exist. I think disclosure and also process is something that over time you try to improve. So I don't have any specific plans, and I haven't really given it much thought. I do think the potential is there. I think about it, particularly as we grind down to low interest rates at some point, hopefully in my lifetime and for future retirees of the world, that will change. And then, you know, maybe there'll be a different type of category. But there wasn't anything specifically in mind. And as far as the universe, we view our universe as basically bonds, which are corporate bonds, convertible bonds. We do buy preferred that are called, so that would be preferred stock. We buy bank debt, and we focus primarily in North America dollar-denominated securities. We haven't really ventured out into sort of non-dollar-denominated and then hedging out the currency or anything because it's really not really something we want to add at this point. But there are all kinds of ways to expand. We're pretty content where we are right now, though.
Great. You'd mentioned building a relationship in the case of the one seller who had mispriced the bond, and you had too earlier mentioned the kind of first mover advantage, and some of our readers were interested in whether or not you foresee a time when other folks would be entering the space and sort of goofing with your ability to get the price that you want.
That
it's unlikely.
First of all, we definitely have seen in a calendar year compression in yields when there's just less product.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, December 15th to January 15th, the buyers are pretty much still there, but there's just less supply. So you do see compression, and we actually manage the maturity and manage the structure a little bit to get through what we consider potentially calendar slow humps. I don't really see, I'm not particularly concerned about somebody major coming in and trying to destroy the market. I mean, all that will happen is the yields will go down, and we'll get this. We'll do the exact same thing we are now, and the yields will be lower, and they're going to end up getting the same yield or lower, or they're going to have to take a lot more risk. And at some point, the underlying investor is going to realize all this and say, I'll go do something else. So I think it's sort of like an orphan drug where there's just a unique area where there's not that many people that want to focus on it relative to bulking up. I do think our biggest competition really comes in twofold. One is we really have a good sense of the flows at the mutual fund level, because when the mutual funds want to raise cash, believe me, we know. So it was actually a period in high yield a couple weeks ago where mutual funds were clearly raising cash, meaning they either – there was so much – and in this particular case, it wasn't that the market was deteriorating. It was there was such so much new issue relative to their inflows that they wanted to sell things to buy the new issues to get the pop, because we were buying things that were called redeemed paper in the secondary market at very attractive prices. The reverse happens as well. If they're getting inundated, if the mutual funds are getting inundated with cash, and there's very few things in the new issue market for them to buy, and they don't really want to buy a lot of old issues, and they think in general, let's say, that on the run ETF, call it the Heidi 100's expensive, which it is, quite frankly, they'll hold cash more. And then the other thing is the hedge funds. I mean, there are a whole bunch of hedge funds where they, believe it or not, they buy this stuff and they use it to offset their cost of shorting, and then they short high yield.
Oh, okay. Great. We're closing in on the one-hour mark, Morty, and so I thought that we would turn to Jamie to give folks in the audience a last shot, and if there aren't other questions pending, we might want to wrap things up.
Once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star and one using a touch-tone telephone. And we do have an additional question. This comes from Gary Samuels. Please go ahead with your question.
Yeah, hi. I actually had trouble with the connection, so I was dropped for the last half hour. So I just got back in, and I can listen to the recording again. But did you talk about how much, if you have too much cash, what do you do with the money then, or are you not worried about securities not being available?
We didn't really talk about it. We generally don't have too much cash, and when we have too much cash, it doesn't last very long. It's not a smooth ride. I mean, if we get a lot of cash in or we have a bunch of bonds rolling off into cash, it's unfortunately not seamless where we can immediately put it to work always. Sometimes we can slog around some cash for a couple of days or even a week. It has been less of an issue when we were smaller. As we get bigger, we're talking a little bit more about it internally. One of the things we've talked about is, you know, do you go out and buy like a 3-day commercial paper of, let's say, Safeway at, you know, 84 basis points? But then you give up that opportunity for 3 days. So I think it's more a function of we're pretty much careful about when we know cash is coming in. We have, I think, twice in the life of this fund bought some commercial paper. One of the periods was actually in the December 15th to January 15th period where, you know, somebody dumped us with a lot of cash on an inflow. There wasn't a lot of called redeemed paper, and we knew there would be a lot of investment banking activity in the middle of January as a historical basis. So and it was hard to find short-term debt that was that much wider than, believe it or not, the investment-grade commercial paper, because our compliance her compliance beeper went off and said, you know, you have too much investment grade stuff. So we do that. It's something we're going to pay a little bit more attention to, and it's an area where we can actually improve the yields by getting the cash more effectively put to work on a turnover basis. We haven't done it because we've been pretty good at getting stuff to work. It generally happens either when there's a doldrums in the market, so call that summer and the Christmas period, or when we get inundated with lots and lots of cash, and the newish calendar is a little bit slower. But one of the things we've been doing is you can buy bank debt and sort of manage your settlement a little bit. That helps as well. I hope that answered your question.
David Snowball,
yes,
this is Morty. I want to thank you for giving us this opportunity. You know, from my perspective, great questions, great opportunity, you know, for investors to get a chance to, you know, meet, you know, so to speak, with David Sherman one-to-one and hear directly from him. And I think you're doing, you know, great service to your readers. So I want to thank you, and I appreciate it. And from my perspective, we'd be happy to do these things, you know, in the future again.
Great. I'm looking forward to the opportunity. Do anticipate having the link for folks like Gary who had to miss out on part of the call. Do you know when you might have a link available for him?
Yeah, I think the unfortunately Matt Kelly couldn't join us, and he has the details there. I think the link will be available over the next couple of days, and it's probably something that we'll be able to share the link to you. It's more likely that you'll be able to publish that than us on our website, because we're going to have to go through, you know, mutual fund compliance in order to get it there, where you basically independently can put it up through your own website. But we'll provide that to you as soon as we can.
Then if folks just want to check the Observer's discussion board, the moment we have a link, we'll highlight it and make it available to everyone.
All right. Thanks again.
Great. Thank you.
Bye-bye,
all for
everybody.
Joining us tonight. Thanks, Dave, for your time, and Morty for your support. Take care, all.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes today's conference call. We do thank you for attending. You may now disconnect your telephone lines.